Ladies and gentlemen, the George Wilder Jr. Show has now arrived. This is Chicago's finest internet radio show, making a world a better place, one show at a time. The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air. Take it away, Dad.
All right, welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show, ladies and gentlemen. Recording this show, like always, every evening, Monday through Thursday, 6 o'clock to 7:30. If we can, if we'll go longer. Anyway, I want to mention one thing that everybody's talking about, and that is the death of Mary Tyler Moore. Somebody's spelling her name M-O-R-E. But anyway, we know who it is. The death of Mary Tyler Moore, Dick Van Dyke, the Mary Tyler Moore Show, if I can say it. And everybody's mourning her. Hollywood is mourning her. And women everywhere are mourning her because they were idols of hers. Even Oprah Winfrey, they were idols. So they are mourning Mary Tyler Moore. She was 80 years old, folks. And the Dick Van Dyke Show, the Mary Tyler Moore Show, those are two of the shows that she's best known for. She has done things before the Dick Van Dyke Show. She's done a lot of stuff, but the Dick Van Dyke Show is the show that most of us got to know her from. And she moved on to further success. So we just want to give our condolences out to her family and fans, you know, people who loved her, and say that she was great. I mean, the Dick Van Dyke Show and the Mary Tyler Moore Show, they are still running in syndication around the country. So you can always find those shows somewhere, maybe somewhere in TV land, something of that. But anyway, she stayed active until... until her health problems gotten the best of her. And we want to say rest in peace, Mary Tyler Moore. from the George Wilder Jr. Show. All right, let's move right along. We are broadcasting live out of the city of Chicago. And it's raining. They're saying that winter is about to return. So if you've been in Chicago and the surrounding areas and you've been enjoying spring-like weather and fall-like weather in January, all of that is about to end. You're going to start freezing your asses off again. Winter is returning to cities like Chicago. So bundle up, girls. That ain't going to happen. That's never going to happen. 20 below zero. You're going to always find people who are out there walking in this cold ass weather, barely dressed because they think they're cute and they have something to show. I don't know. But anyway, welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show. You can follow me right here on Blog Talk Radio, right here at this website. And you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I'm all over the place. I'm on Google. Sometimes I'm even amazed how quickly I can be found on the internet. Someone called me one day and said, "Mr. Wilder, you're all over the internet. That's good." I don't know if that's good or not. I don't know if that's good. It's a lot of scammers out there. It's a lot of people out there who will steal your ID. Steer your identity, if I can say. I was going to say identification. They'll take that too. So, yeah, you're all over the internet, Mr. Wilder. You are all everywhere I look. You're all, well, things happen, I guess. Anyway, what is the latest news today? Okay. Trump sets out on his promise to build a wall. And he has signed an executive order for it to go through. Building a wall between Mexico and the United States on the West Coast. Some people say it's a good thing. Some people say it's not a good thing. Some people say it's not going to work. Some people say it will work. You know, I want to say that if a wall is constructed along the borders between Mexico and the United States, we will see if it's going to work or not. We don't know. I mean, a lot of people speculate. We're speculating that if it's going to work. If it's done, I mean, I don't know if I can say I'm all for a wall, if I'm all against it. I'm still somewhere in the middle, you know, but Trump's the president. And he's doing so many things in his first week in office. It's unbelievable. And I've heard that he has stripped money, federal money. He's blocking all federal money from cities and states that call themselves sanctuary to illegal aliens. This is happening. Already, he has stripped money from all states for sanctuary cities. I can imagine some of these illegals who depend on those sanctuary cities to keep from being deported. I can imagine what's going through their minds now. A lot of these people are heading back to Mexico. Or they're going into deep hiding, you know. But Rahm Emanuel, I mean, this guy, he's so steadfast against deportation against some of these illegals. It's funny, but without the money, you can't really keep hiding them and keeping them safe from deportation. I believe Emmanuel is going to use some of taxpayers' money. Once the federal money stops coming for sanctuary cities in city of Chicago, I think Emmanuel is so loved these people so much that he's going to take taxpayer money to protect them with. Yeah, he's going to use taxpayer money, but that's going to run out. And taxpayers are going to be pissed off using that money in that way. When we have so many homeless people around here, we have these schools that we have to take care of. We have property taxes and on top of other taxes. So, you know, I mean, it's going to be something to watch. Yeah, he's blocking all federal money. And he signed executive orders to do these things. One of the things I know about Trump, he loves doing stuff. He loves trying to get things done. I don't think no president in history has come into office and done so much so quickly without thinking. Without thinking. And now he's, you know, ordered a probe into the voting irregulations, which is stupid. He's saying that two to three million illegals voted in the last election that cost him the popular vote. It cost him the popular vote. Nonsense. This guy is ignorant. I mean, and he's going to get his Justice Department to look into it, to investigate it. It's stupid. That's crazy. He's trying to come up with some excuse to why he did not win the popular vote. In essence, he lost the election. You know, he lost it, but the only thing that saved his ass is the Electoral College vote. Illegals can't vote. Give me a break. And this did not happen. The election officials would have known this quickly. And another thing, look at the women's march, marching all over the world for him, protest everywhere. That should tell him something right there, that these people did not vote for him and they were in the millions. I just think Donald Trump just cannot stand illegal immigration and Mexicans. I just think he don't like them, and he's trying to find every excuse that he can so he can justify throwing them out of the country. There's 11 million illegal immigrants in the country, and Donald Trump wants to throw, or will throw, them all out. So he's trying to give himself some justification by saying that all these illegal voted for me, I'm going to throw their asses out of the country. You know, that's what I think is going on, you know. And he's doing so much so quickly. I'm thinking that he's not actually in his right mind to be doing all of this. But he's president and he has, you know, he can do it. He has the power to do it. You know, I mean, he has the power to yank all this federal money from these sanctuary cities that are protecting illegal aliens. I mean, you've got, if you think about it, you got a lot of illegal people going to these social service agencies, getting food stamps. They're getting driver's licenses. They're getting rental assistance. They're getting all the things that you or I or any American would be able to get, you know, but they weren't born here. These are the directives from the mayors in some of these cities, and directives from some of the governors, not all, you know, the Republican governors. I don't think they're going to go for that. But majority of the people who are harboring these illegal Mexicans in some of these sanctuary cities are Democrats. And I think Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, is going to start using taxpayer money once the federal money has dried up to protect illegal immigrants. He's going to use taxpayer money to protect them. And I think there's going to be a bitching about that in the city of Chicago. I mean, you don't want your money to go to someone. At least I don't. You know, I don't. I'm not racist. I'm not prejudiced. You know, I'm just saying money's tight, you know. And, you know, we just have to wait and see what the coming days will bring for what Donald Trump has done. You know, so he has stripped all the money from sanctuary cities. And I can imagine what, like I said before, I can imagine what some of these illegals are thinking, especially the dreamers, the children of illegals who were brought here when they were small. And all they know is America. They don't know Mexico because their parents came over here illegally and had babies. And that's one of the reasons why illegals come to America. Some of them come on visas. You know, they get visas. And once they get here on a visa, you know, they stay, they don't go back, you know. They stay, and Donald Trump is cracking down on that, the giving of visas in some of these countries, you know. So anything immigration, that Donald Trump doesn't like. He's going to put in motions. He's going to put in the motion to get things done. He doesn't care what anybody say. He doesn't care if you like it, you don't like it. You don't care if you hate him or you love him. Donald Trump is going to do what Donald Trump does. You know, I mean, he was voted in office and he made all these promises. And I'm going to tell you something, folks. He's acting on them. He is acting on these promises. All right. You've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. My guest is author Chandler. I think it says Chandler Scott. And he's going to be on the show in a little bit and we're going to see what he's talking about. I'm thinking it's a man. Okay, we're going to take a little break right here, folks, and we will be right back. Welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show. All right. Donald Trump is also talking about the crime in the city of Chicago. He's calling it carnage. Basically, what he's saying is that if the mayor, the police superintendent, if they can't do something about all the carnage in the city of Chicago, he's going to send in the feds. Now, that's kind of a blanket statement because we don't know what he talking about when he actually means the feds. There's nothing specific. Maybe he's going to send in the National Guard, and people are saying, no, not the National Guard. We don't want that. But I think it's necessary. A lot of people are speculating, you know, let things happen. If it doesn't work after they happen, Then you complain about it, but don't complain about it if it hasn't happened yet. You know, we got a lot of people like that. People are saying that, no, we don't want the National Guard here. It'll be a bloodbath. We don't want the guard on every corner. I think they should have the United States Army over here in some of these rotten neighborhoods, some of these gang banging, gang slanging neighborhoods where the people can't even walk to the store or sit on the porch or even look out of their window for being afraid there may be a bullet coming through. You know, I'm all for the National Guard. I mean, I think they're long overdue, but I understand that the mayor doesn't want the National Guard. They don't want the National Guard. They just don't want it because in my thinking, it will make them look like failures, the failures that they are. We're on the brink of having more murders committed in the city of Chicago than 2016. We need help. I don't know why these politicians are turning down. Even Governor Rauner, he doesn't think the National Guard is going to do anything. Stop speculating. Stop guessing. Stop trying to foresee the future. Put them over there. You never know. You got to try something. You got to do something. You just can't let people die. You just can't let these young punks run around, these young thugs run around with guns shooting people. The police is not doing their job. They're not up to it for some reason. You know, I would think that the federal FBI should come in, you know, and just take it over. Take this from the Chicago police and handle it their way, because the Chicago police, in my estimation, has failed. They has failed the people of Chicago. Mayor has failed the people of Chicago. Because the crime, the carnage, the shooting, everything. And now they're rejecting the National Guard when they need all the help that they can get. You got police officers who are not doing their job because they feel they're going to wind up on YouTube or whatever, or they may lose their position. I've said this on the show the other night. If you're a police officer and you're not doing your job, if you're afraid to go on a call or to stop someone that should be stopped on the street, then you should not have that job. Police officers, especially the superintendent, get paid pretty good money. They have big paychecks. Taxpayer dollars. If you can't do your job as a police officer, then you should quit. And I'll say this again. I think the mayor should resign. I mean, all of these people should resign because they don't have a clue. I may not agree with some of the things Donald Trump is saying, but at least he has the courage to say them. He has the courage to do them. And a lot of the people who heard that Donald Trump, especially in the city of Chicago, a lot of people who heard that Donald Trump was going to send in the feds if the city could not get a handle on the crime, they were happy to hear that. These were African Americans. They were happy to hear Donald Trump say that he was going to send in the feds if the city, Mayor Emanuel, Superintendent Eddie Johnson, if they could not end the carnage. I agree. I think they do need help. I think they need help. I think they need a lot of help. Because they are blaming the parents. They're blaming gun laws. They're blaming the judicial system. They're blaming everything on someone else and not putting anything on the police, as if the police doesn't have a stake in this. Well, it's bad parenting. Well, they're letting the criminals out of jail too soon. Well, they're not processing gun crimes. Blah, 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 blah. You know, and it's not working. It's not working. They get paid to serve and protect the people of Chicago. And folks, it is not happening. If everybody is dying over here in these high crime areas of the city, and it's making news. It's making national news, worldwide news. It's almost, I had one girl call. She said, George, I'm embarrassed to say that I'm from Chicago. I said, join the club. people are leaving. People are leaving Chicago. People are leaving some of those high crime neighborhoods in Chicago. I mean, the population of the city of Chicago is low. We are the third largest city in America, soon to be the fourth largest city in America, because of the carnage, the crime, the killing, the shootings, the muggings, the thugging. I live on the north side of the city. Not much of that is over here. Okay, so, I've had people say, well, George, you're in Chicago. Yeah, I'm on the north side. I'm not saying I'm safe over here. The things don't happen over here. Things do happen. I mean, this is Chicago. Things happen all over the city. But it just so happens to happen or to occur more in these high crime areas of the south and west sides of the city. You know, I'm on the north side. You know, and we don't see too many police officers over here because they actually, in some cases, they're not needed. They are needed where the bad guys have taken over the neighborhoods, taken over the communities with drugs, prostitution, sex trafficking, crime on top of crime, the residents, the people who live there, they are terrified. They can't go to the store. They can't walk down the street. They can't go to the park. They can't sit on the steps. They can't hang out in front of their houses or their apartments or whatever. It's just awful. And this has been happening for years. You know, it has to stop. It has to stop. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. We have a clip here on some of the things. If we can go down and down and do this. Okay, let's do this.
Do blacks commit more crimes than other races? The simple answer to this question is yes. The black population of the United States is approximately 13%, and the white population is approximately 62%. These are the FBI crime statistics for 2014, where blacks accounted for 27.8% of the total amount of arrests for that year, an obviously disproportionate amount for a population of 13%. The overall level of arrests for black people is higher than might be expected in almost every category, except for driving under the influence of alcohol. Black people accounted for most of the arrests for murder, 51.3%, robbery, 55.9%, and gambling, 58.9%. They were also significantly above average in several other categories. Weapons crimes, 40.7%, prostitution and commercialized vice, 41.8%, and aggravated assault, 33.1%. A common criticism of these figures is that they are based on arrests by police officers who may be disproportionately targeting black neighborhoods due to racial bias or profiling. However, these statistics seem to be corroborated by the National Crime Victimization Surveys performed by the Department of Justice. The latest NCVS data is from 2008 and is collected by a random survey of 90,000 households. Blacks are consistently disproportionately represented in these surveys, correlating closely with the arrest figures. In addition to this, the number of black police officers has remained steady since 2007 at 12%, while being 13% of the population. There has been a marked rise in non-black ethnic minority officers, but despite police efforts, recruiting blacks into the police force has been challenging due to criminal background checks and a cultural attitude towards the police as an institution. Naturally, murder and non-negligent manslaughter is the category missing from the National Crime Victimization Survey, and it is also the most focused on by the media. Homicides by victim and perpetrator are often presented as percentages as victim and perpetrator by race, which gives a chart that looks like this. Most murders are committed by a perpetrator of the same race as the victim. This obfuscates the severity of the problem by making the number of murders look evenly spread between both racial categories, with a small crossover of black-on-white or white-on-black crime. However, displaying the number of murders brings the issue of disproportionate violence committed by black people into focus. When someone says, "Black lives don't matter" to "Black lives matter," this is what they mean. Black men are responsible for murdering other black men at a rate that is near parity with the murders of white men by other white men, when white men are 5 times as numerous as black men. These murders are usually committed with a handgun. So the question becomes, why? As Aristotle said in Politics, poverty is the parent of revolution and crime. There are many studies that positively correlate poverty with non-violent and violent crime, but I've chosen to use the Edinburgh Study of Youth Transitions and Crime performed by researchers from the University of Edinburgh. I've used this study because the black population of Edinburgh is approximately 1%, and the United Kingdom is a modern, industrialized, English-speaking, Christian heritage, first world democracy. This study has been done predominantly on white British people, and I want to showcase this to demonstrate that poverty has a distinct effect on people regardless of any inherent biological differences, and to remove the possibility that these results are due to racial discrimination. The Edinburgh study followed the lives of around 4,000 young people as they made the transition from childhood to adulthood, using both self-reported data from the young people themselves and linked data from a range of official sources. The researchers studied the effect of childhood poverty on violence in the teenage years, and examined its impact beyond into early adulthood. The researchers have set out 4 measures of poverty: socioeconomic status of the head of the household, whether the young person was not in education, training, or employment at age 18, whether the young person has been unemployed for more than a year at age 22, neighborhood deprivation based on census measures of poverty in the young person's area of residence. The study found that poverty had a significant and direct effect on young people's likelihood to engage in violence at age 15, even after controlling for the effects of a range of other factors known to influence violent behavior, even when taking into account of a raft of risk indicators that would be expected to increase the propensity to engage in violence, including poor family functioning, the lack of attachment to school, substance misuse, and impulsivity, and a range of protective factors that are known to act as preventatives, such as a strong and positive relationship with the parents. Young people who were living in a family where the head of the household was unemployed or in low-status manual employment, and those who were growing up in communities with high levels of deprivation, were significantly more likely to engage in violence. Household poverty appears to act as an exacerbating factor and increases the chance of such young people offending. The Edinburgh study provides evidence that children living in poverty are overrepresented among violent offenders. Even taking account of this increased risk of offending, however, right, children from poor backgrounds are disproportionately selected into the juvenile justice system and retained there by decision-making that is based on, amongst other things, their impoverished status. Previous work has shown that this type of systemic processing labels and marginalizes the most vulnerable young people in society, making it difficult for them to move on from offending as they mature. The system causes structural failures that prevent those in poverty from moving out of this condition, and in the longer term, this constrains opportunities and reduces life chances. As Aristotle recognized more than 2,000 years ago, poverty breeds criminal behavior. The Edinburgh study came to an interesting conclusion as to why this behavior would involve violence. For most young people from the most impoverished backgrounds, violence provides a touchstone against which identities are honed. More particularly, violence empowers and is a means of attaining and sustaining status among peers. Willingness to use violence, therefore, becomes a resource for the most dispossessed, and this becomes a persistent feature throughout the teenage years. It follows that poverty will create increased levels of non-violent crime, such as theft, burglary, or drug dealing. But in the absence of available wealth as a status symbol, impoverished young people use capacity for violence instead. According to Pew Research Center data from 2013, black children are 27.3% of the black population, but 38.4% of those living in poverty. US Census Bureau data from 2014 shows that while overall, 18% of families in the US with children under 18 live in poverty, this number rises to 32.1% for black families. The poverty rate for black families with intact marriages drops to 10.8%, but rises dramatically in cases of unmarried single parents. 31.2% of single fathers with children under 18 are impoverished, as are 46.1% of single mothers with children under 18. These figures follow the trend of economic hardship for single parents throughout the rest of the United States, albeit slightly more exaggerated. This has resulted in the black children living in poverty outnumbering white children living in poverty, in spite of white children outnumbering black children by 3-1. U.S. Census Bureau data shows that over half of black children do not live with their biological fathers. Unmarried black mothers with children under 18 are the most impoverished demographic in American society, and they are the most common type of family structure in black communities. A 2005 study from the University of California called The Effects of Poverty and Economic Hardship Across Generations found that economic pressure appears to be the key mechanism linking hardship to a cascade of effects on children's development. The distress caused by poverty seems to predict lower positive, i.e. self-confidence, good school performance, supportive relationship with peers, and higher negative child outcomes, i.e. antisocial behavior, depressed mood, and symptoms of anxiety. In contrast, higher family income and the investment in children's development appear to have beneficial influences on long-term developmental success. Taken together, the family stress model and investment model suggest an intergenerational transmission of poverty and economic hardship. The family stress model of economic hardship proposes that financial difficulties have an adverse effect on parents' emotions, behaviors, and relationships, which affect their parenting or socialization strategies. According to the model, the emotional distress of poverty predicts conflict and reduces warmth and support in parent-child relationships. These relationship disruptions contribute to children's emotional and behavioral problems, academic failures, and poor cognitive functioning. The investment model suggests that economic resources increase the investment parents are able to make in their children's development, promoting academic and social competencies. With increased resources, parents are able to invest in the development of their children, providing the special care, time, and services necessary to support their children's emotional needs. These investments contribute to enriched learning environments, higher standards of living, and safer homes and neighborhoods. Greater family resources appear to reduce risks associated with the stress of poverty and help create environments that promote competent development. Instability is another key factor in the emotional well-being and intellectual growth of a child. A 2013 study called The Negative Effects of Instability on Child Development, a Research Synthesis, describes the effects of poverty and instability. Children thrive in stable and nurturing environments where they have a routine and know what to expect. Although some change in children's lives is normal and anticipated, sudden and dramatic disruptions can be extremely stressful and affect children's feeling of security. Within the context of supportive relationships with adults who act as a buffer against any negative effects of instability, children learn how to cope with adversity, adapt to their surroundings, and regulate their emotions. When parents lack choice or control over change, they may be less likely to support their children in adapting to the change. Unbuffered stress that escalates to extreme levels can be detrimental to children's mental health and cognitive functioning. The experience of economic instability causes increased material hardship, particularly when families lack personal assets. Low family income negatively affects children's social, emotional, cognitive, and academic outcomes, even after controlling for parental characteristics. Children's cognitive development during early childhood is most sensitive to the experience of low family income. Parental employment instability is linked to negative academic outcomes, such as grade retention, lower educational attainment, and internalized and externalizing behaviors. The effect on grade retention is strongest for children with parents in a high school education or less, whereas the effect on educational attainment is stronger for blacks than whites, males, and firstborn children. In dual-income households, the father's job loss might be more strongly related to children's academic outcomes than the mother's job loss. Job instability leads to worse child behavioral outcomes than when a parent voluntarily changes jobs, works low-wage jobs full-time, or has fluctuating work hours. Family instability is linked to problem behaviors and some academic outcomes, even at early ages. Children's problem behaviors further increase with multiple changes in family structure. Family transitions that occur early in children's development prior to age 6 and in adolescence appear to have the strongest effects. While young children need constant caregivers with whom they can form secure attachments, adolescents need parental support, role models, and continuity of residence and schools to succeed. Children demonstrate more negative behaviors when they lack the emotional and material support at home that they need to smoothly handle a family transition. Poverty is bad for children's emotional and cognitive development, and poverty is more likely to be the consequence of single-parent households. The next factor to consider is the subculture many of these young people are inculcated into. It should be no surprise that large numbers of delinquent, impoverished young men with poor education and lacking in fatherly role models would find acceptance within criminal gangs. In 2012, it was estimated that there were 30,000 gangs operating within the United States, with over 800,000 members. Blacks make up over 35% of these gangs, while whites make up less than 12%. These gangs are, of course, predominantly young men, and they are mostly located in large cities. Gang violence accounts for a hugely disproportionate amount of violent crime. Gangs are responsible for an average of 48% of violent crime in most jurisdictions, and up to 90% in several others. Major cities and suburban areas experience the most gang-related violence. Local, neighborhood-based gangs and drug crews continue to pose the most significant criminal threat in most communities. Aggressive recruitment of juveniles and immigrants, alliances and conflict between gangs, the release of incarcerated gang members from prison, advancements in technology and communication, and Mexican drug trafficking organization involvement in drug distribution have resulted in gang expansion and violence in a number of jurisdictions. As covered earlier, black people accounted for most of the arrests for murder at 51.3%, robbery at 55.9%, and gambling at 58.9%, and was significantly above average in several other categories. Weapons crimes at 40.7%, prostitution and vice at 41.8%, and aggravated assault at 33.1%. These are all common gang activities, and are without a doubt raising the resulting statistics for black crime. You may have noticed that the statistics for black crime have often been juxtaposed against Hispanic crime, with Hispanics having a higher rate of poverty and criminal gang membership, but a lower propensity for violence. I think this can be adequately explained by a lower rate of single-parent families, 31.2%, and a strong cultural tradition of deep familial ties, but I do not have any data or studies to validate this. So, why do black people commit more crimes? To be specific, young black men commit more crimes, far more than any other racial demographic. They are much more likely to come from an unstable, impoverished, single-parent, matriarchal household. They are more likely than young white men to lack a strong male role model. They are much more likely to seek acceptance in gang culture, leading to the acquisition of a criminal record, reducing employment prospects, and putting the individual into a downward spiral of poverty, which further incentivizes criminal behavior as a source of income. If you don't mind me speaking in more generalized terms and giving my opinions on the matter, it seems to me that these people are victims of circumstance. For many black men, the deck has already been stacked against them from their earliest days. They suffer from many societal handicaps that are beyond their control, that directly affect their cognitive abilities and emotional well-being, and find themselves with reduced options from social stigma attached to poverty before any other factors need to be introduced. So I know what you're thinking. This is the white man's fault, isn't it? And the answer is no. There is no one group at which the finger can be pointed with any reliability to say, you did this. If I may conjecture, I think the fact that black people can be visually distinguished from white people has provided an intellectually lazy trap in which it's easy to fall. It's very convenient to self-validate by inventing excuses for one's own poor choices, to project the responsibility for them onto mythical concepts like white supremacy, and dismiss other successful black people as Uncle Toms. Not only does it allow one to place the blame on an entity that can never refuse it, but it also allows one to ignore convenient facts regarding the inconsistency of this white supremacy and its apparent concern with the welfare and social advancement of black people. So how can this be fixed? The good news about all of this is that it is completely within the power of black people to solve the problems plaguing the black community. The first and, in my opinion, most important step is to begin the process of rebuilding the nuclear family. This will provide emotional and financial stability to black children and their parents, and it will provide incentives for the parents to achieve and set a good example for their children to follow. It will require black parents to take personal responsibility for themselves and their children. Subsequently, in time, this will improve the reputation of these communities through the improved moral character that they will display. To put it simply, I am recommending the empowerment of the black community through their own force of action. The barrier to this is little more than the will to change on the part of the members of this community. Am I saying that there is no racism in the United States? No. Racism will always exist on an individual level, and some individuals who are racist will always end up working in structures of power. However, to clumsily paraphrase Thucydides, I think the current state of black communities can be explained without recourse to placing the blame on a remote and abstract concept such as racism when there are so many direct temporal explanations for the current state of affairs. This is not a dismissal of the many instances of police brutality and racial discrimination. These events occur with alarming frequency. However, they are also not a barrier to the solutions required to the current problems facing the black community in the United States.
The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air. This is the talk of our time.
All right. Donald Trump is also, is it seems that this guy is welcoming waterboarding and torturing. I mean, he has no problem with it. Other people do. Most Republicans do not have a problem with waterboarding. They tried to outlaw it, but Donald Trump seemed to be impressed with it. He figures we can get a lot of information out of torturing people. And we're going to have to see where that goes. But Donald Trump is doing a lot, folks. Like, he's doing so much. I think the guy is doing too much, too fast, too soon. I mean, he's got 4 years. I mean, he can probably take some of his time to do some of these things, but he's working diligently and he's working quickly. And you wonder how much thought he's put into this. Not just saying he's going to do something, but put thought in the ramifications and the reactions that's going to be coming from other people by his own pen, because he's doing everything by executive authority, Nothing is going through Congress legislatively. So once if Donald Trump is successful doing a 4-year term as president, the next president that comes in, they can sign all of that away. They can undo him. His executive actions, just like he's undoing Obama's executive actions. So, you know, I think it's best, if you're going to get something done, I think it's best to get it done through working with Congress and not always an executive action, because it can be undone quickly by, you know, you can just erase it off the books and it's over, you know. So, but I mean, this guy is really, really he's serious about America. He's serious. And one of the things that, and I talked about this earlier on to the show, one of the things is that, you know, about, you know, him saying that illegals, two or three illegals in the United States voted against him. That's why he lost the popular vote. That is so, that is a bunch of malarkey. People all everywhere from agents on up are telling him to get off of it. That's not, he's still tweeting, folks. Yeah, I mean, this guy's crazy tweeting. I mean, he's going to tweet out a nuclear bomb or something, you know, and he's still tweeting. And I don't know, you know, I want him to be successful. When I say I want him to be successful, I want to see him get through these 4 years. I know he's going to do a lot of things you don't like. I don't like. He's going to the protest against Donald Trump. They're going to be out there almost every day, every time he does something, at every place he goes. He's going to have to live with it. He's going to be sleeping with protesters. He's going to be sleeping with people who are rallying against him. You know, this because there's still people out there who thinks he's an illegitimate president. There's people still think that he's not a real president. They feel that, hey, Russia played a part in this. They feel that... You know, was Russia and some of the element played a part in him becoming president. And a lot of people will never accept a Donald Trump as president. There's going to be plenty of people who are going to be resisting Donald Trump as president. He knows all of this. He knows it, but he's ignoring it like he should. You know, I do think, like so many other people, that he should get the hell off Twitter. He, for God's sakes, he's the president of the United States. Man, this guy, I mean, I don't even use Twitter as much as he does. And, you know, I'm Facebook. I mean, I use Facebook because a lot of times when whatever I post on Facebook winds up on Twitter anyway. So, you know, and... Donald Trump, he loves Twitter. I mean, he's made Twitter really, really popular. Tweeting, tweeting, tweeting. I mean, you know, he's president of the United States. He's got to get real. But as I was saying earlier, he has yanked money from all sanctuary cities that are harboring illegals. Right now, I'm pretty sure illegals are just up in arms. And I do not want to see Rahm Emanuel take... which he probably will, because he loves them. And that's not a racial slight. I just don't want to see my taxpayer money going to someplace I don't want it to go. And that's one of the things about politicians who have their hands on your tax money. They can put your money anywhere that they want it to go without your approval. And that's when you come in, on the next election, when they're running for re-election, vote their asses out, you know. So I don't think Rahm Emanuel is going to get back in office. This guy is too weak. I mean, Democrats are weak. They are weak-kneed. They cave in. They give up. And money has been stripped away. And I was surprised. I thought they were going to fight it. But, you know, if you have federal money coming in and suddenly it stops, what's going to happen? It's going to be a domino effect, maybe. You know, so yeah, Trump is really doing things too much, too fast. But I'm pretty sure, I'm pretty sure that there's a lot of people out there that are probably saying, go Trump, especially his supporters. He's got a number of supporters. And I actually think the guy is getting more support as he goes along, because there's people who are probably supporting him who did not vote for him. You know, so I just think that Donald Trump is trying to give himself an excuse to deport all of these illegals in the United States, and Muslims and people of color who are not, you know, citizens of the United States. And he's having his way. Like I've told so many people on Facebook and social media, get the popcorn. 4 years is going to be a long ride, and this guy's got all the power in the world. Oh, Keith Olbermann, one of my favorites, Keith Olbermann, he's calling on Trump to resign. Yeah, he's saying, Trump, you got to go, man. You're insane. He's saying Trump is crazy and he's not fit for office and he should not be there. And I have been told that I've read that, I even heard from Keith Olbermann that Donald Trump can't stand him. And I can see why. Keith Olbermann, I mean, he runs this show. I think it's an internet show or a blog. He calls the resistance. You know, I just love that. He used to be on MSNBC until they fired him. I'm assuming that they fired him. Allegedly, they fired him. But he's now, and I enjoy his show. I have some of his clips right here on my show, and I love hearing Keith speak, even if I don't agree with him. But majority of the time, I do agree with him, and I love to hear him speak because he speaks from his heart. He speaks the truth. He is focused. He thinks before he speaks, and he's just a ramrod up Trump's ass. And he said that Trump is insane. Trump is crazy. Donald Trump should resign. He's not the only one that have espoused that, but he's the one of the most notable ones. You know, so and if you haven't heard his resistance, it's all over you can find it on the YouTube, you know, I mean, it's everywhere. And his, every segment that he does, it is just it's so informative. I mean, Keith there's no one like him. I mean, I even admire Bill Maher. I think Bill Maher is just great. I think Bill Maher, Keith Olbermann, these guys are my heroes. What can I say? I could never be like them. I could never speak to them. You know, I can just, you know, admire them, you know, for their courage in saying what they say. You know, some people are afraid to talk. These guys are not afraid to talk. They'll tell you what they think, you know, in a minute, and they'll use curse words while saying it. And that's what makes it so interesting. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. Follow me on Facebook, Blog Talk Radio. I'm all over the place, folks, and we are in a new era. We are in a Donald Trump era. I try not to cover Donald Trump so much on my show because I consider my show a variety show with mountains of different kinds of topics and issues that I can talk about that we can talk about. But Donald Trump, he's just the elephant in the room. He sucks up everything. And because every day there's something new coming out of the Oval Office, and this guy hasn't even been in office a week, maybe 2 weeks, a week and a half, and he's done so much right now. And we just have to wait and see. Okay, we do have Elizabeth Warren, and this is from the Women's March last weekend, and she's got some things to say about Donald Trump. Here is Elizabeth Warren on the George Wilder Jr. Show. Go, Elizabeth.
Hello, women of Massachusetts. And hello, friends of women of Massachusetts. Yeah. I love you too. I am glad to have this chance to stand shoulder to shoulder to fight alongside the mayor of Boston for the people of this country. Thank you. So, we're here today because of the power of women. The power of women to come up with good ideas like this rally. The power of women to organize like this rally. And the power of women to make sure that as our country enters a new political era, that the voices of the people will be heard. yesterday Donald Trump was sworn in as president. That sight is now burned into my eyes forever. And I hope the same is true for you, because we will not forget. We do not want to forget. We will use that vision to make sure that we fight harder, we fight tougher, and we fight more passionately for than ever, not just for the people whom Donald Trump supports, but for all of America. People are worried. Donald Trump's campaign was about attacks on women, attacks on African Americans, attacks on Latinos, attacks on religious groups, attacks on immigrants. A Trump-Pence Supreme Court could overturn Roe versus Wade and dissolve marriages of LGBTQ citizens. A Republican Congress is eager to rip away health care from millions of Americans. America's hardworking families have taken one punch after another. Decades of trickle-down economics and attacks on unions, attacks on wages, attacks on pensions, attacks on health care, attacks on Social Security, attacks on education, attacks on infrastructure and financial regulation have gutted America's middle class. A broken criminal justice system, a broken voting rights system, and decades of systematic racism have kept people of color from having the same opportunities as other Americans throughout this country. The fact is that the playing field has been tilted badly in favor of those at the top for a generation now. And now, President Trump and the Republican Congress are ready to ram through laws that will tilt it even harder. Now, we can whimper, we can whine, or we can fight back. Me, I'm here to fight back. I'm here to fight back. And that is why we come together today. Hundreds of thousands of people in Boston, in Washington, and across this country, we are in marches to say we are fighting back. That's who we are. We come here to stand shoulder to shoulder, to make clear we are here, we will not be silent. We will not play dead. We will fight for what we believe in.
Yeah! You bet.
We have a vision, and that vision defines who we are as a people. First, we fight for basic dignity and respect for every human being, period. No compromise, no backing up. And second, we fight for economic opportunity, not just for those at the top, but for everyone. All of our kids deserve a fighting chance to get ahead. Everyone, economic opportunity for everyone. That is the American deal, and that's what we fight for. You know, those core principles call out the best in who we are. For too long, American families have seen a government and an economy that isn't working for them. And Trump and the Republicans promised to make America worse. But we're here because we are ready to fight for the people who want to build a country that works for all of us. That's why we're here. We come together to give each other strength. We come together to give each other courage. We come together to remind each other of our values. As we get ready to march, let us remind each other what we believe in and why we fight and why we will keep right on fighting. We believe that no one in this country should work full time and live in poverty. And that means raising the minimum wage. Yes, it does. Paid overtime, sick leave, we will fight for it. We believe that workers have a right to come together and to bargain together. Unions built America's middle class, and unions will rebuild America's middle class. We believe that every young person is entitled to get an education without getting crushed by student loan debt. We believe in debt-free college. Now, I'm going to say something that is really controversial in some places in Washington. We believe in science. Change is real, and we have a moral responsibility to protect this earth for our children and our grandchildren. We also believe that immigration makes us a stronger country. We will not build a stupid wall. And we will not tear millions of families apart, not on our watch.
Doing it.
And we believe that sexism, racism, homophobia, and bigotry have no place in this country. Black lives matter. Diversity makes our country strong. We believe that equal means equal, and that's true in marriage. It's true every place. We will never stop fighting to ensure equality for all of our citizens. You know, I could do this all day. One more that I cannot believe I have to do in 2017. We believe in equal pay for equal work and a woman's right to decisions over her own body.
Yes.
This is what we believe. This is what we will fight for. This is what we will march for. Are you ready to fight?
Yeah.
Are you ready to march?
Yeah.
Are you ready to make sure today and tomorrow and the next day and the day after that that our voices are heard across America? We will be out there every day. Let's go march!
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Senator Ed Markey.
All right.
All right. I enjoyed her speech, but as soon as she said that we don't need no stupid wall, Trump is building a wall. And, you know, he may be defying her. He may have heard the speech. And it's clear that Elizabeth Warren does not like Donald Trump. There is no doubt about that. She doesn't like, and I don't believe he likes her that much. Remember when he was calling her Pocahontas? And she lividly didn't like that. But anyway, I love the speech, and we're going to have Elizabeth on the show from time to time. And yeah, it's just, as I was saying yesterday, folks, and I hope you were listening to the show yesterday, it was a good show, great show as always. We are in some really trying times with Donald Trump. We don't know what this guy's going to do. A lot of us feel as though he just may get us all blown off the damn earth. We don't know what he's going to do, but we do know what he's capable of. We do know that. And all I can say is keep your fingers crossed and let's try to get through this with Donald Trump. But I have a feeling, folks, he is just so controversial and he's so thin-skinned. And remember when he actually said that everybody who didn't vote for him were losers, you know, and I guess he's calling me a loser, you a loser, if you voted for him or not. He was just saying we were losers because we didn't vote for him and we didn't support him. So we were losers. That's what Donald Trump does. If you don't, you don't like Donald Trump and you say that you don't like him, if you don't like some of the things he does, he's going to come back at you and call you all kind of names and say what you do is overrated or underrated or whatever. He's going to come back in a negative way. You know, I mean, I've been on this earth a long time and I never seen a president or heard of a president doing the things that this guy does. Remember, Trump has never had a public office. He's never ran for office. He's a businessman. And some people say he's a flim-flam man or a con man. And I think that's one of the reasons why he's in office. He probably conned his way into the White House. You know, some people believe that. You know, some people believe he's illegitimate. You know, some people believe that he won those states with all those electoral votes, that he and his minions went over there and conned those people with the most electoral votes of any state to vote for him. And the popular vote went straight to Hillary. And now he's bitching about the popular vote, saying that the reason why he did not win the popular vote is because, and he's launching a federal investigation into this, folks. He wants this investigated that the popular vote didn't go to him because 2,000 to 3,000 illegals voted. And that's a total farce. That's a total lie that he and his press secretary are telling every day. And they think we're dumb and stupid to believe it. Donald Trump is just giving himself a reason to deport illegal immigrants, to deport Mexicans. He's giving himself a reason to do that. And by yanking money from sanctuary cities, it's starting. It has started. Mexicans, illegal Mexicans, dreamers, or whatever you want to call them, they are about to be ousted. Without money going to these sanctuary cities to protect them, they're going to be out in the open because they, you know, it takes money. And like I said before, I'm hoping that, and I hope people really jump in Rahm Emanuel's butt about this, if he's thinking about using taxpayer money to protect illegal immigrants. If he wants to protect illegal immigrants, he can use his own money and start his own personal and private sanctuary city for him. You know, but don't use my taxpayer money for this. You know, I need my cash. I need mine, you know. So don't do that with my money. You know, I mean, I'm pretty sure a lot of people probably thinking the same thing. Because as of now, Chicago is no longer a sanctuary city because it has no sanctuary money. And that's one of the things that Trump campaigned in his campaign on was that he was going to crack down on sanctuary cities that protect illegal immigrants from being deported. You know, he promised that and he has done it. I mean, it takes money to run anything and he's done it. He's yanked money from these cities. I mean, when you take away the money, what do you got? And he's going to, some cities and some mayors are going to sue Donald Trump. They're going to sue the government for this. They're going to, and I'm sure Trump is going to lawyer up. I mean, he's got lots of lawyers, so he doesn't, you know, this doesn't bother him. Actually, I think he's got a court. I actually think he's being sued right now by some people saying that there's some sort of conflict of interest during that he still has some sort of interest in his business, and he's collecting, you know, profits from his business while being president of the United States. So we're going to see where that goes. We're going to see where if it goes anywhere. You know, Trump's got lots of money. He's got lots of lawyers. He knows how to buy people off, pay people off. A lot of these women that were thinking about suing him, you know, they're not suing him anymore because somehow Donald Trump and his team done got to these women, probably done paid them off, you know, stuff like that. And they are not talking. You know, that could have happened. Who knows? But anyway, we do know that he's being sued by the people I just got through mentioning. And some, I think a woman is suing him for sexual harassment or some sort, something to that effect. I'm not sure, but I'll find out more about it. And she said she just wanted an apology or something like that. She got one of those high-priced lawyers. I can't think of her name right now, but who cares? Anyway, it's going to be an interesting ride with Donald Trump. It's going to be a hell of a roller coaster with this guy because he's doing something every day. Every day he's making news in some way all the time. I mean, every time you turn around, Donald Trump has done this. Donald Trump has did that. Donald Trump has, you know, wiped away this. But there's no doubt about it. The guy is undoing Barack Obama. If it's an executive order that Obama has done during his tenure, it's being wiped away by Donald Trump. So, and I'm pretty sure there would be no legacy of Obama. Donald Trump is the big elephant in the room, and everybody is paying attention to this guy because this guy is doing so much. He's one of the things about Donald Trump that Barack Obama used to do was compromise. Donald Trump is not about compromising the way Obama was in his presidency. Because that's all Obama talked about, compromise, 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 compromise. Donald Trump don't give a damn about compromise. He's going to do what he's going to do, whether you like it or not, whether you talk to him about it or you chat about it or get together. He doesn't care. Donald Trump is going to do what the hell he wants to do, regardless if you like it or not. You know, and I was a fan of Obama, especially when he was first running. When he was campaigning, I was a great fan of his. But once he got into office and I saw him and witnessed him running up after Republicans, the first thing he did in office when he became president was not sign bills into law. He didn't do anything executively. When the first day, I believe, when he was sworn into office, after his inauguration, he went down to Capitol Hill trying to compromise and be nice and to Republicans, who later on just slapped him in the face. Obama once said that I've been over backwards for these guys, and I said in my social piece, that's a wrong use of words, but figuratively he has bent over backwards for the Republicans who only kicked him, and he still ran after them. I remember there was a time in Obama's presidency where we thought Obama had become a Republican because he was giving away everything, Social Security. He was giving away stuff for the seniors. And I mean, we was, wow. And at one time it affected one of my jobs I had, that he had stripped the funding from that position and gave it, was giving it to the Republicans, but somehow the Republicans refused, you know. But but now we got Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is making us forget Barack Obama pretty damn quickly, you know. So, well, I mean, what else can I say, folks? We are in a new world. We're in a new era and a new way of doing things. Some of us probably will adapt. Some of us will not. It's the way of the world. Some of us will think something is wrong. Some of us will think nothing is wrong. And that's one of the things about America is that America is so damn divided. I mean, we were divided during Barack Obama's tenure in office. We are more divided than ever in any time in American history. We are divided, folks. Black people over there, white people over there, Mexicans over there, illegals over here, and everybody's bitching at each other. You know, Donald Trump right there in the middle. We are so divided, and that's a damn shame. We don't trust anyone. We don't interact anymore. We're suspicious of everybody. I mean, is that a way to live? Is that a way to actually be in America in 2017? I don't know. You know, I mean, when I first, I guess a lot of us, when we first heard of Barack Obama and that he was running for president and he was campaigning with his family, oh man, we thought that this man was God. We thought that he was the Messiah. We thought that he was coming in to change Washington for the better. It was going to be different. Things were going to be great. Wow, were we disappointed. Even Barack Obama himself said that he was dismayed because he could not bring people together. And he's admitting it right now that he did not do a lot of the promises he made that he did not keep. He admits this. And he admits that he could not bring or did not bring people together like he should have. And he was wishing, and he actually wished that Hillary Clinton would have won the White House, because there's no doubt about it. If Hillary Clinton would have won the White House, it would have been Barack Obama's third term in office with Hillary. And there was a lot of people who did not want that. They did not want a third term Obama. That's why if people voted, they voted against Hillary because they didn't want a third term Obama. Obama just could not move people anymore. And he admits it, that he couldn't move people anymore, even though he was racing around from country to country, radio to radio, television show. He could not move those people who once voted for him to vote for him a third time. They went to Donald Trump. Obama had disappointed them. Obama had, you know, broken his promise, didn't feel a lot of his promise, especially African Americans felt burnt by Obama. There's no doubt about it. I know that people are saying, well, Obama's got a 60% approval rating. Obama had a high approval rating leaving office because people were comparing him to Donald Trump. So if you're comparing Barack Obama to Donald Trump, of course he's going to have a high approval rating. Of course. I mean, because most people hated or didn't like or did not support Donald Trump. They love Barack Obama, Michelle Obama, and their two girls. They were the honeys of the world, leaving the White House. But generally speaking, Obama was a disappointment to blacks overall. I mean, you had all kind of black leaders jumping in Obama's ass, saying that, wow, he was a disappointment. He did nothing for blacks. And African-Americans were the ones who voted for Obama and gave him two terms in office in the White House, and they got nothing for it, period. Tavis Smiley, Louis Farrakhan, you name them. Jesse Jackson on the south side of Chicago, Jesse Jackson. A lot of these people and more were critical and are critical of President Barack Obama. And not just me, not just the George Wilder Jr. show. You know, so Barack Obama was a disappointment. Okay. I mean, you may love him. You may like him. You may. Well, that's you. That's your prerogative. But on this side of the aisle, on this side of the fence, he wasn't the president that a lot of us thought he would be. A lot of people didn't get in. There are so many people in poverty more than they were when he ran for office, more than they were when they voted for him. You know, jobs in the African-American community. I don't care how much you talk about the economy. Jobs in the American community is at an all-time high. Ask anybody. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. We got just about 4 more minutes left into the show, people. We are going to do this. Thanks for tuning in.
Heaven help the child who never had a home. Heaven help the girl who walks the streets alone. Heaven help the roses if the bombs begin to fall. Anyone who never saw. Heaven help the black man if he struggles one more day. Heaven help the white man if he turns back away. Heaven help the man who kicks the man who has a crawl. Heaven help us all.
Everybody, for listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. We are just about off the air. I want to say I hope you guys are back here tomorrow night when we're going to have some more exciting things to talk about. We're going to have a great guest on the show tomorrow. All right. I want to thank everybody for listening to the show. Make sure you join me tomorrow. Bye-bye, everybody. Thanks for listening.